Thank you. As Bob Dinnerstein noted, and by the way, I want to live in Bob's future. It's truly a strange and funny place, and I'd like to be there. As Bob noted, this is now the eighth annual Ten Brook Conference, and it is hard to imagine how we did without it before we had it. I think it is extraordinary that the National Federation of the Blind has kept this and made this just one solid year after another of great presentations. And by far and away, the credit, because they don't just happen by themselves, the credit for all this goes to Lou Ann Blake. And thank you once again, Lou Ann, for a fabulous conference. The other thing I love about these conferences is, you know, it's like a high school reunion without the insecurity. I mean, there's just so much love and of a different kind. Important things happen in the hallways away from the meetings. In any event, a couple weeks ago, Mark Sharmatz and I were asked to go over to University of Maryland Law School and talk about the first 25 years of the ADA, and we were invited by the Journal of Race, Religion, Gender, and Class to give that talk, and I thought, this is really nice. Somebody is thinking about disability as part of diversity, which happens occasionally as an afterthought, but is certainly not normally the case that disability is thought of in diversity except among disability rights advocates. My excitement about that was tempered somewhat by the fact that the invitation came from one of the editors who's been working for us as a paralegal for 4 years. But Mark delivered a very upbeat assessment of the first 25 years, so I was a little embarrassed to get up and say, well, you know, if you look at where employment was 25 years ago for people with disabilities and you look at where it is now, I mean, there's been some progress in physical access, although Larry pointed out earlier all the areas that there hasn't been, but it was, I just wasn't able to point to some landmark victory. So I thought, well, that's okay. I'm gonna talk about the next 25 years at Ten Brook, and this is my chance to do a Dan Goldstein version of I Have a Dream. And I can do it with, you know, Disney bluebirds singing as the sun rises. And then I actually started thinking about what I truly think about the 25 years. And as Eve indicated, I'm going to be a real downer. back when I was young, which is before I knew Dr. Maurer, there used to be an expression, what if they held a war and nobody came? What if they had a civil rights movement and nobody noticed? I don't think we've had our Selmas. Selma came into our home each night from Walter Cronkite and Huntley and Brinkley. And we, whether we wanted to know or not know what was going on in Alabama and Mississippi, we were finding out because it was in our face to think about and talk about every night as we sat down to dinner. I'm not sure that the world has yet noticed that there is a disability rights movement. And I thought Ari hit the nail on the head yesterday when he said that the law may be ahead of the culture change here. And it's really the implications of that that I want to talk about, because I don't think in the end you can win without the culture change. The core problem of disability rights, and here I'm saying nothing that nobody is new to anybody, are the invisibility of persons with disabilities and the misperception of persons with disabilities when they are visible. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this because I think you both, everybody here knows, but the most common response when we sue a business, an entity of some kind over discrimination is, oh, you know, we weren't thinking about people with disabilities when we, fill in the blank, didn't put in the curb cuts, designed the inaccessible software, didn't budget for ASL interpreters, whatever. You know, it's like the Steve Martin routine on Saturday Night Live, I forgot bank robbery was a crime. The second problem, the misperception of persons with disabilities when they're visible, is the exclusion of people with disabilities because of a belief that they can't do something, and so they're denied that opportunity. Recently, we had a blind student at a community college who was barred from taking any classes that had a lab because of the belief that the student would be a fire hazard. And we all know the key to the misperception problem. It's the word amazing, right? I saw this blind guy, he scratched his ear without even seeing where his ear was. And he talked like a normal person. Wow, he's amazing. And if you look at how when we do make the news, right, 90% of the time it's disability porn. This wonderful person who did something, you know, amazing and isn't that brave and heroic and so on. So were we visible? I mean, I think that the symbol of a person using a wheelchair in the bathrooms and parking spaces has been the most ubiquitous reminder to the oblivious that they share the planet with persons with disabilities who also have rights. But we have to somehow solve these misperception and invisibility problems. And so I want to talk about one aspect of this going into the future, because right now we have among ourselves some sense of who are persons with disabilities, and is that going to change? And if so, is that going to change the perception of persons with disabilities? And a couple of weeks ago, I shared my thinking with some of my fellow panelists, including Arlene, and she was kind enough to pass on some thoughts from Mary Lou Breslin that I'm going to just flat out plagiarize, although I do have quotation marks in here, because I think it's exactly what I'm thinking about here. Genetic testing, amnio interventions, gene manipulation, and early detection of old as well as newly identified conditions will most certainly reduce the number of people with what are thought of as the more traditional disabilities, such as spina bifida, dwarfism, certain forms of deafness, Down syndrome, autism, et cetera. Replacement biotechnologies will also evolve and will further mitigate conditions that are characterized by activity limitations if the implants and devices are affordable, such as arthritic hips, knees, shoulders. You know, I'm at an age now when I meet an old friend, we start with the organ recital, right? Disease, lungs, livers, et cetera. Smart technologies will radically reduce the impact of other limitations, such as amputations, vision loss, et cetera, and chemical advances will generate new drugs for scores of physical and mental conditions that impair function and cognition if the current research trajectory continues. I'm sure we could add more examples to that rather impressive list from Mary Lou Breslin. But one of the things is this is going to strengthen the medical narrative that is so antithetical to rights. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm just saying it's going to strengthen the medical narrative. And also, what happens if there are only 20% as many blind kids in the school system and we have all this technology? Are we really going to be able to insist on Braille literacy? Are we really going to be able to succeed in getting people to understand why Braille is so important and has to be provided? And what happens if the co-occurrence of disability and age increases? This is possible, although a lot of money is going into research around this large population. But it will strengthen a perception of disability as associated with a general lessening of capabilities, especially because the ability of many older people to learn new adaptive techniques to address any limitations from their disability and that would mitigate the impact of the disability. will strengthen the perception of that disability as extraordinarily limiting. If you see that Great Aunt Josie can't do X, Y, Z anymore because of a particular disability, you're going to think that's characteristic of the disability rather than characteristic of Great Aunt Josie, right? If the general public sees few of us in job positions, and that certainly is the case so far, capably carrying on a normal life, and more of us as Great Aunt Josie, we're going to have image problems. I do think there are going to be areas in which we will see an increase in disabilities. Dr. Meyer talked about the connection between poverty and disability, and I predict, sadly, that as income inequality continues, we're going to see a closer and closer intimacy between poverty and disability. We may well see increases in PTSD, diabetes, respiratory conditions, behavioral and emotional disabilities in our poor neighborhoods because the triggers for those disabilities are right there in poverty. And just as there exist many who believe that the poor are poor as a matter of personal failure, that belief can extend to things like obesity and diabetes. My partner Andy Levy told me, I showed him an early draft of this, that he learned that Bon Secours Hospital here in Baltimore, which serves a poor population, the number one most frequent surgical procedure at Bon Secours is amputation relative to diabetes. So, I also think it's likely we're going to see an increase in the incidence of disability in the developing world, or at least less of a decrease compared to the demographics in US and Europe. So the face of disability may be that of Sierra Leone or Haiti, very much strengthening the pity narrative, the narratives that are so antithetical to rights. All of which is to say, I guess, that if we look at disability rights as purely a matter of law, us great lawyers changing the world, I think we're in big trouble. I think we have to focus very hard on communicating to the world who we are and what it means to be who we are. What it means to be disabled, in huge part, depends on what people believe that word means. And that meaning is going to change, in the next 25 years with or without us. It is not too soon to create a concerted effort to learn how we can guide the cultural conversation and make that part of what we think about as we do our work. Thank you.